You're listening to KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
When I stopped in to visit with Robin White, the superintendent at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site, I had no idea that our conversation in her office would lead so quickly to tears. I had interviewed Miss White a couple years ago, and at the time we stayed on track, keeping the focus surrounding the September 1957 events at Little Rock Central High School and the subsequent lessons learned. On this visit, I decided on the spur of the moment to change the focus if she was amenable. I said, let's talk about lessons learned, but more importantly, lessons not learned in the intervening six decades. I had no idea that my entree would open the floodgates of her soul. The subsequent conversation quickly had tears running down Miss White's cheeks and mine too. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me in Miss White's office in Little Rock, Arkansas, as she shares her profound, powerful thoughts and feelings that she confessed are way too often regretfully stuffed and suppressed. Robin White.
Good morning. My name is Robin White. I'm the superintendent at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site, a unit of the National Park Service, which was established in 1998. And it was established to commemorate school desegregation and the Little Rock Nine. 60 years ago, you had nine Afro-American students that had this ideology about equality and wanting to pursue an equal education. That was 60 years ago, and the struggle continues.
One would think that we would have made some progress since 1957, and one would think that a lot of things that happened in the 50s and before would have been history. And yet we see some of the endemic racism within society and communities still rising their ugly head.
There's a term that I call space occupants apology, whereas we're constantly apologizing for our existence. It seems like we need permission for our existence, people of color. And you look at how society prescribe, and I call it a society prescription, prescribe how we are supposed to perceive or see each other. We don't see each other in totality. We see each other by color, by economics, by class. We do not see each other in the eye of humanity. And with this come so many faults and struggles, whereas many of us want to stand in our convictions and just be ourselves and perceived as a human being, but we are labeled and put into boxes. And lately, sad to say that we have become a footnote. When you watch TV, you see the news, and all these senseless lives are taken. When you take a life, you're taking a generation. You're taking generations of what's to come. You're wiping that out. You're wiping out that seed. And you're looking at the news, and here you see another man lost his life, and it's basically a footnote. And that's what we have become. And we are better than that. We are supposed to be better than that. We're supposed to be bigger than that. Why? Why is my dark skin a sin? Why am I looked at as different? We're all different. That's the beauty of us. That is why we were created. All this difference is what make all of us so wonderful. But to the core of me, I should not be struggling to be accepted. I should not be struggling for someone to see me in my totality. And it is so painful. I don't think people understand what it means to get up every day. We can't take this skin off of us. This is who we are. I value myself, and I know my worth, but others don't see that. They don't see my worth. They don't value me. We don't value each other. And with that, we are doing a disservice to each other. We are doing a disservice to the next generation, to our children, because they see that. How can we ready them? How can we prepare them to make decisions for our future when we are making all these bad decisions ourselves?
It seems to me that that explains so much for that momentum and that reason for Black Lives Matter, exactly what you're talking about.
People say all lives matter, and they do. But when you are losing a life every day, back to back, my brothers and sisters are just dropping. There's something wrong. When people don't see, this has been going on since we've been here. The only difference now is that we have social media, that it's in real time. And no one would have believed it if we did not have social media. We would be perceived as liars, basically, that we're making this up. And still people, some people are still in denial. They could see it, but sometimes it's just too much for them to wrap their head around, and they continue to deny it. We need a voice, yes. So when Black Lives Matter come into existence, there is a purpose. There is a purpose when we are looking to stand in our convictions. There's something that I believe in. Not only do I have a purpose, but we also must live on purpose. And we can't live on purpose if our lives are continually snuffed out. We can't live on purpose and make a difference if we are dropping like flies and no one is held accountable, or no one can see what's really going on because they are too blind, or they are just in denial because it's just too much. Black Lives Matter exists for a reason, and we need that. We need the support. We need the support of people that are not of color. We need people, just like during the movement, you had people from all across the nation, different denominations, right, ethnicities, everyone came together. We need that same support to overcome this. This hump, this is a big hump to overcome this. And we're not saying that all policemen are bad, but in every group, there is going to be a bad core. There is going to be a bad apple. And the only way to flush it out is for those, his colleagues, to step up and stand up and say, you do not represent me. You know, in the National Park Service, we wear our uniform with pride, the green and gray. We wear it with pride. And we have over 400 units, whereas we represent the story of a people. We're here to protect and preserve our natural resources. The same thing is that police officers are here to protect and preserve. You can't protect me if you fear me. You can't protect me if you are afraid of me. And I can't see you if I'm afraid of you. All I see is fear. And I fear for our children. I fear for my people. And this is heavy, very heavy on my heart. But not only my heart, all of us, we're all carrying this weight, and we should not have to. This belongs to all of us, and we all have a responsibility to each other.
What is your best feeling and idea for going forward, for exactly what you're talking about, for your children, for the future? How do we rise? How do we grow?
I think first, some of us have to admit that we're dealing with manufactured fear. A lot of this is synthetic fear. And this manufactured fear can no longer be justifiable to take a life. You cannot use this as an excuse to take a life. How can we see each other in totality if we fear each other? We have to have conversations. I think one of the greatest things that we can do is actually not only have training on sensitivity in our communities with law enforcement, but also with our residents. All of us need to be exposed to the struggle of a people and looking at civil rights. I don't think it should be one side. It needs to be both sides for us to understand each other. We need to come to that medium whereas we could have conversations. You can't continue to fear me. We have to develop some respect for each other or with each other to move forward. We can't keep using excuses. I think that once upon a time, we knew who our police officers were. They knew our families in the community knew each other. And the policemen were part of our family. That no longer exists. They're not part of our family. And you have this code, this culture. Well, we all have a culture. And if we could find a way to break down some of those social and culture barriers, we could cross those thresholds and see each other and respect each other and work together. The communities belong to all of us. Like, even as a park ranger or as a superintendent, my job is to serve the community and learn what their needs are. How can I serve them if I don't have a relationship with them? How can I give them or develop programs that are relevant to them if I don't have a relationship with them? And it's the same thing. We have to work together and get to know each other to diminish those social and culture barriers.
You are actually doing that here. I saw your brochure on some of your presenters and whatnot to do that outreach and to have people from Black Lives Matter come here and talk. So this really is an important community center, in a sense, right here. Your National Park side.
It is very important because we belong to the community. Community raised me. And with community raising me, I'm here to serve the community. The National Park Service is a vessel for me to serve the community and provide a forum for people to tell their narratives. We don't own their stories. My job is to provide a venue, a forum for them to tell, for the residents to tell their story, to write their own narratives. That's my job. That's my responsibility. And with that, opening those doors, more doors open. And we're making that connection, whereas it's a shame, and we're linked, 1, 2, 3, we're all working together. And that's what I see as being a servant and being a servant leader or being a servant to the community, for the community to tell me what they want and me to work with them to deliver what they want and making sure that it's relevant to them.
Robin, in your life, as you look back and you look forward, has there been progress sociologically, community-wise, that you've seen in your life, or has it been kind of a stasis?
Of course, there has been progress in different parts of the community, and even with me, I would say, growing up with my parents were sharecroppers coming from a Mexican plantation in Slaughter, Mississippi. Growing up in the bayous, growing up in the low country. So I've always been of the earth. I've always been of the earth and connected to the earth as far as looking at where I come from. And so we all belong. It's the problem is many of us struggle to be accepted or to belong. If you don't know who you are, if you have no foundation, it makes it even harder. But yes, there has been tremendous progress, but that does not mean that we can't do better. We must do better.
Looking forward, looking to the future, what is your best hope and how do we rise to that next level?
Step by step. We have to own this, I don't want to say monster, but there is some darkness here. How can we move toward the light if we don't even admit or own that darkness that we're standing in, that we're sitting in? And then moving forward, we have to admit what is going on, own that, and then look at solutions. And it takes all of us. It can't be one person. It takes all of us from the community. That means law enforcement. That means special services. That means social organizations, social justice organizations. All of us have to work together. The bad part about this is that...
In which ways are y'all working together now?
We have town hall gatherings right here at the Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site. We are having those conversations right here at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site. We have the FBI, local FBI, that will come in and have conversations with the community. But they contacted us because this is what they want to do, and this is what they want to be a part of, solutions, looking at how we can move forward. We've had conversations, a program called Conversations of Color, and talking about from Alabama, or Birmingham to today, and looking at our progress, where we were then and where we are now. We have to do it step by step, but it is so important to own it. We have to admit that there are some problems. We have to admit we're not perfect. And then come together to have that dialogue and looking for solutions. In November of last year, we had what we call a social conscious gathering where people from across the country, even from Northern Ireland came, all of us came together. And we were talking about religious divide. We were talking about economic inequality. We were talking about the education system and how it is going. We're regressing. It's becoming separate again. But not equal. And so we could talk about the problems, but we also must look at solutions. And it is our responsibility to go back into our communities. And so you had Dr. Habrowski, the president of Maryland University. You had Dr. Herschel from the Jewish community. You had rabbis. You had people from the Muslim community, Islamic. All of us came together. People that were connected to Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland, all of us came together. We had youth from Philander Smith College, from Arkansas Baptist, and people came from as far as Boston. But all of us came together to talk about the here and now, the American Indian Movement. We had the American Indian Movement and the FBI in the same room. And we were talking about how we can move forward. But I don't have the answers. I don't have all the answers.
It sounds like that is your best hope and best answer for our communities, is conversations.
It is definitely conversation and coming together in your communities and taking ownership of your communities. Because I can't go in your community and tell you how to solve your problems. Identify your problems and then how you can come together to move forward and looking for some resolve and solving them. And definitely youth must be at the table. Our children must be at the table. And we must teach them about this decision making, because they will be making decisions on our behalf in the future. So we must ready them. They see all of this craziness going on. And this summer I had a house full of youth right here at the site. Most of my employees were youth, and they were in so much pain. They were in so much pain that we had to come together and sit down and talk. We had to let them express themselves. And with that, I decided that we have to continue this conversation. We must. And so we're meeting. Yes, we'll have a conversation with Black Lives Matter, but most of this is actually launched by our youth as well. And of course with journalism, but is launched by our youth as well. We have to give them that platform where they can express themselves and allow them that space and time to grow. But also we have to start that healing process, because they are in so much pain. If we are hurting, I know I'm hurting, then how is this impacting our children? And we have to take that into consideration.
Wow. Robin White, thank you so much. You've made my day once again. Absolute pleasure to be with you.
You're most welcome, and I appreciate it.
The underbed music was performed by the St. Mark Baptist Church Sanctuary Choir, recorded live in Little Rock, Arkansas. Before we go, let's take a step back in time to Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas, 1957.
I know the law, will make a way.
September 4th, 1957. Summer vacation was over, and it was the first day of school in Little Rock, Arkansas. 9 black children attempted to start classes at the all-white Central High School, but their entry was blocked by hundreds of Arkansas National Guardsmen. They'd been sent out on direct orders issued by Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus to block the entry of the 9 students who will forever live on in history as the Little Rock 9.
Units of the National Guard have been and are now being mobilized with the mission to maintain or restore the peace and good order of this community.
President Eisenhower subsequently dispatched the 101st Airborne Division and placed the Arkansas National Guard under federal command.
Such an extreme situation has been created in Little Rock. This challenge must be met. The troops are there pursuant to law solely for the purpose of preventing interference with the orders of the court.
With bayonets fixed, more than 1,000 federal troops provided protection and escorted the 9 black students into the school as hundreds of taunting, rock-throwing white men and women venomously protested.
What about you, sir? Do you think the colored students will show up?
If I got anything to do with it, they won't show up. Well, I think it's a breaking point of the school integration. I just don't feel that they have a right to go to school.
The 9 were reluctantly allowed to attend classes, but not without endless harassment and abuse. And they were not allowed to attend any extracurricular affairs, proms, programs, or sports. Phyllis Brown, the little sister of Minnie Jean Brown, who was one of the Little Rock 9.
How old were you?
I was 9.
Do you remember what was going on?
I remember lots of stuff about it. I remember the terror. I remember how it had affected our household, our family, not only the Brown household, but how it affected the families of all of the nine, how they were all fractured and had to build itself back up, and how we were all sent away to live with relatives.
Your parents were fearful for your lives.
Yes, we were in a state of terror. You know, right now the world keeps using the word terrorist, but strangely they didn't use the word terrorist during 1957, but it was terrorism.
When you think of your sister, do you remember her strength? What comes to your mind when you watch her going off to school?
I remember words. I remember pictures of her smiling, mm-hmm. in spite of the fact that she had been kicked or pushed down the stairs or hit. There are pictures of her smiling.
And isn't that just incredible to see that strength and that optimism and power in one individual?
It runs in our family.
I can tell.
Yeah. My father said to my mother in 1957, let that girl go to that school. Yeah, she can go to that school. And then to hear my mother say she had to do it, you know, that tells me who I came from.
Your sister, did she complete high school?
She was expelled from Central.
Oh, really?
Yes, and you will hear her say, even currently, how bad it made her feel that she was expelled. But her expulsion was to her response to being terrorized.
She was attacked by some white girls. Tell us what happened with that.
Yes, daily attacks. Throughout the day, all kinds of attacks, and one day she responded. She was expelled.
What did she do then? How did she graduate from high school?
Oh my gosh, she must have had some kind of guardian angel on her shoulder, because she was invited to New York City to live with the famous doctors Kenneth and Mamie Clark. And she graduated from New Lincoln High School.
And then she went on to college. Tell us what she did with her life and her career.
She did go to college. She went to Southern Illinois University, met her husband, and went to Canada. And she forged a life as a Canadian.
Phyllis Brown, what a pleasure and honor to visit with you.
Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas. Troops, which for nearly 3 weeks lined the sidewalk here in front of the high school under orders to keep the colored students out, have been replaced now, and their orders to comply with the law, which means let the Negro students in if they come in.
The events of September 1957 at Central High School was a seminal turning point in America's civil rights movement, and the lessons learned live on at Little Rock Central High School today. I'm Tom Wilmer.
Make a way. Said he would make a way. Said he would make a way for you, for you and me.
Well, I know the law.
September 4th, 1957. Summer vacation was over, and it was the first day of school in Little Rock, Arkansas. Nine black children attempted to start classes at the all-white Central High School, but their entry was blocked by hundreds of Arkansas National Guardsmen. They'd been sent out on direct orders issued by Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus to block the entry of the nine students who will forever live on in history as the Little Rock Nine.
Units of the National Guard have been and are now being mobilized with the mission to maintain or restore the peace and good order of this community.
President Eisenhower subsequently dispatched the 101st Airborne Division and placed the Arkansas National Guard under federal command.
Such an extreme situation has been created in Little Rock. This challenge must be met. The troops are there pursuant to law, solely for the purpose of preventing interference with the orders of the court.
With bayonets fixed, more than 1,000 federal troops provided protection and escorted the 9 black students into the school as hundreds of taunting, rock-throwing white men and women venomously protested.
What about you, sir? Do you think the colored students will show up?
If I got anything to do with it, they won't show up. Well, I think it's a breaking point of the school integration. I just don't feel that they have a right to go to school.
The 9 were reluctantly allowed to attend classes, but not without endless harassment and abuse. And they were not allowed to attend any extracurricular affairs, proms, programs, or sports.
This is Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas. Troops, which for nearly 3 weeks lined the sidewalk here in front of the high school under orders to keep the colored students out, have been replaced now. And their orders to comply with the law, which means let the Negro students in if they come in.
The events of September 1957 at Central High School was a seminal turning point in America's civil rights movement. And the lessons learned live on at Little Rock Central High School today. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as we visit with Phyllis Brown, the little sister of Minnie Jean Brown, who was one of the Little Rock 9, as she recalls the pure terror her family and friends lived with 24 hours a day.
We were in a state of terror.
We'll join Robin White, superintendent at the Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site, as she shares her passionate insights into the history and lessons learned.
They never expected the community to respond in that manner, to project so much anger or hostility.
And then we'll join Rex Deloney. He's a teacher at Central High School today, and he'll share his insights into the legacy of the Little Rock 9 that lives on palpably in the classroom, in the hallways, and throughout the entire community of Little Rock, Arkansas, and across America.
That's the same place they had signs saying, get away. And now all it says is, welcome to Little Rock Central High School.
My name is Phyllis Brown.
Tell us about your relationship to Little Rock and your sister in a point in time in history. How old were you when the Little Rock 9 event happened?
I was 9.
9. Do you remember that time? Do you remember what was going on? What did you think?
I remember lots of stuff about it. I remember the terror. I remember how it had affected our household, our family, not only the Brown household, but how it affected the families of all of the 9, how they were all fractured and had to build itself back up, and how we were all sent away to live with relatives.
Your parents were fearful for your lives.
Yes, we were in a state of terror. You know, right now the world keeps using the word terrorist. But strangely, they didn't use the word terrorist during 1957. But it was terrorism.
When you think of your sister, do you remember her strength? What comes to your mind at that point in time when you watch her going off to school?
I remember words. I remember pictures of her smiling in spite of the fact that she had been kicked or pushed down the stairs or hit. There are pictures of her smiling.
And isn't it just incredible to see that strength and that optimism and power in one individual?
It runs in our family.
I can tell.
Yeah. My father said to my mother in 1957, let that girl go to that school. Yeah, she can go to that school. And then to hear my mother say she had to do it, you know, that tells me who I came from.
Your sister, did she complete high school there, and then did she move away to college?
She was expelled from Central.
Oh, really?
Yes, and you will hear her say, even currently, how bad it made her feel that she was expelled. But her expulsion was to her response to being terrorized.
She was attacked by some white girls. Well, tell us what happened with that.
Yes, daily attacks throughout the day, all kinds of attacks. And one day she responded. She was expelled.
So what did she do then? How did she graduate from high school?
Oh, my gosh. She must have had some kind of guardian angel on her shoulder because she was invited to New York City to live with the famous doctors Kenneth and Mamie Clark, and she graduated from New Lincoln High School.
Wow. And then she went on to college. Tell us what she did with her life and her career.
She did go to college. She went to Southern Illinois University, met her husband, and went to Canada, and she forged a life as a Canadian.
Phyllis Brown, what a pleasure and honor to visit with you.
Robin White, superintendent at the Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site.
Hi, Robin. Welcome.
Thank you. And I'd also like to welcome you to Little Rock and to Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site.
Tell us about what is so extra special about this site in your heart.
I have to take you back. I would like for you to travel with me a little bit and take this journey back to nearly over 100 years ago, to New Orleans, Louisiana, where there was a strategic plan to address the Constitution and to address this law, this separate but equal law as far as the rail cars in New Orleans, Louisiana. Homer Plessy, along with the Citizens Committee, come up with this plan. Homer Plessy was jailed for riding in the front car. He was arrested and jailed, and this case was taken all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
These were street cars, right?
These were street cars, railroad cars. And he was jailed and went to court contesting this law, stating that it was unfair to separate people by their color or by their race. Of course, that was the birth of the separate but equal doctrine, as he lost that case in decision with John Ferguson. Well, then we go forward to another case that was tested in the court with the education system, Brown versus Board of Education.
And that was 54?
That was 1954, May 17th, the U.S. Supreme Court landmark decision, where it was stated it was unconstitutional to separate the students by race in the education system. Well, this was in 1954, so 3 years later, that decision was tested in Little Rock, Arkansas, where 9 African-American students enrolled in Central High School. And these students, basically, just, you know, regular students that saw an opportunity to pursue an equal education, whereas, of course, you know, even though we say separate and equal, of course, the books would not be equal. The school, science department, things just were not equal, okay? Just leave it at that. And enrolling in Central High School would give them a better opportunity to pursue their education. And, of course, it was contested with Governor Faubus raising a ruckus. You know, you think about it. You think about our kids today going to school. You wake up getting ready to fresh clothes, your new clothes, your shiny shoes, and you take off for school, and you're greeted by a crowd, a hostile crowd that protesting your entrance to the school or to go to school with their children. So what is special about this site is that we could say Little Rock was the catalyst of the civil rights movement. But what is really special about this site is that you had students standing in their moral convictions, their moral beliefs, that they had the right to have an equal education.
And they knew they were risking their literal lives to stand up.
Yes, they did. I don't think they realized the depth of it in the beginning, because these were students that they played with in their communities, that they had a friendship with, you know, so they taught. And they never expected the community to respond in that manner, to project so much anger or hostility.
Pure hate.
Pure hate. Yeah. You're right. You're right. And so this site represents many things as far as a symbol of nonviolence, the pursuance of an equal education and equality, but also courage. Taking an opportunity to pursue and stand in your birthright heritage. We'll make a way.
I remember as a little child, I was in Washington, D.C. I remember watching the news and seeing that, and it was just so shocking and stunning, almost paralyzing for a lot of people to see that reality. And when those kids first arrived and there was lines of National Guard, they were not there to protect them.
The National Guard actually were commissioned the governor to actually keep them out.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth Eckford was one that a student that you see with the crowd behind her, screaming at her and surrounding her. And each time she attempted to enter, they barred her entrance. And they did the same thing with Terrence Roberts as well. It's so powerful that you have this child, and in all her innocence, and surrounded in this vicious mob, screaming and hollering, and she is standing in her convictions and holding it all together and pursuing her dream, and at the same time, and this attack, and you just want to do anything in your power to protect her. Also makes you reflect on just the beauty of this, the strength of this child, keeping it together, not running, not falling apart, but walking in grace and walking in glory. That's what I see.
Yeah.
And it gives me strength when I am faced with a challenge that I could pull from her strength to continue my journey, because that was the journey, the beginning for a lot of people. When we look back and reflect on that and see that moment in time, that this is a moment in history where it gives all of us the strength to move on, to move forward, and standing in our beliefs and convictions.
What a powerful moment. I think of myself, what if I walked across the street to that high school and there were 1,000 National Guardsmen and 1,000 white people that were there spitting and yelling at me to tell me to just go away? What would I do?
What would you do?
I don't know. I really don't. I visualize that moment and that image, and I don't know. You know what I'd like to say? Sometimes easier said than done.
Yeah. But I have to look at it is that everything that happens for a reason. And you look at what I see is moral courage. That's what I see.
Yeah.
And we have to take from that time in our history, because this is America's history, and this history, this belongs to all of us, and this is all of our birthright heritage. To take from this in a moment of learning and applying that in our everyday life. What does this mean to Little Rock? Well, sometimes we are faced with individuals that feel that Little Rock got a raw deal.
How so?
The media portrayed them as a racist community.
Yes, even and though it was one segment of.
Exactly, one segment. But I also look at it, this was a turning moment in history, in our time, that this was a moment that Little Rock became a symbol also of the civil rights movement, because this was inevitable.
Since it's the Alamo of the 20th century.
Definitely. This was going to happen, and it just so happened to be Little Rock. It's just so happened the media were there, because it could have been Boston, it could have been Kansas, it could have been Virginia, it could have been D.C., but it just so happened to be Little Rock. And now is the time to embrace our history. And now is the time to actually accept, learn from it, use it as a moment of reflection, and to build on it. Because this is definitely a building and learning opportunity.
It's hard for me to even talk right now. I just returned from the high school, and it was so poignant to see what Little Rock High School has become. Can you talk to us about what you see and experience today from a truly multicultural standpoint?
We interact with the students almost on a daily basis, and you have over 2,700 students in the school. We have a Youth Leadership Academy, and with that Youth Leadership Academy, there are 9 students that represent the Little Rock 9. The bulk of those students are from Central High, and they stand for defining character. They stand for nonviolence. They stand for being agents of change. They take pride in their community and learning who they are, knowing who they are, and becoming a part of this history. I am very proud to interact with them on a daily basis. They have so much to offer, and we have so much work to do. And it's our responsibility as Council of Elders to provide that forum, that venue, for them to grow and invest in them. Because those students today that we're investing in, we have a responsibility to prepare them to sit at the decision-making tables. In the future, they will be making decisions that will impact us. So that's our responsibility. And they know that. They know that we care. They know that they are a significant part of the National Park Service. And they know that this is the only school that is an essential part of the National Park Service, an operable school.
That's hard for anybody to even comprehend until they come here, to realize that a working public high school is literally a living part of a National Park historic site.
Yes. This means that we are constantly working with them on projects. We have what is called the Memory Project, and we have a group of students that go out and interview the elders to talk to them about race divisions, to talk to them about differences, what it means to be different. And from those interviews, a book was born, the Memory Project. And now they're working on a second book. Those students believe in what they're doing. They believe in social change, and they're on that journey of making a difference in this world. We're teaching them about, or sharing with them, the aptitude of being servant leaders and what it means to be a servant to your community. They are growing, and we are watching them as our responsibility in planting those seeds of greatness with those students. They, in turn, are planting seeds of greatness in their community.
Of the Little Rock Nine, eight are still alive. Do any of them still return to talk to the kids?
Yes. We work very closely with them. Elizabeth Eckford still resides here in Little Rock, and so does Tama Mothership. Minnie Jean Brown just relocated back to Canada. She returned to Canada. She was living here the past couple of years as well. Dr. Roberts works with us consistently, as well as Ernie Green and Carlotta. Carlotta is the president of the Little Rock Nine Foundation, and so we have a very strong relationship with them. The beauty of this is that they don't have to be here in Little Rock for us to work with them. Carlotta lives in Colorado, when she has the opportunity to speak about her journey in the Little Rock Nine in the National Park Service, she's still representing us. Ernie Green is in D.C., the same team. That's our responsibility, is to assist them as they tell their story, but also they're representing the National Park Service. So they do not have to be here in Little Rock to share their journey.
But what a precious gift for the kids today to be able to talk to them in person. That's so rare.
We talk to them about living history. And I love my question is history dead? That's my question. Is history dead? The second question, is history important? Why and why not? And you get so many different responses, but they know that history is alive, and they know they are a part of this history, and they also know that they are making history, that they have a responsibility.
A legacy.
And I ask them, what is your legacy? What is your legacy? What will you leave? And that is something to think about. What is their role in society? You know, society prescribed how we should act, how we should look, how we should sound. I think that individualism is important, whereas we are not consistently adhering to what society prescribes. We also look at what I call space occupants apology, and we have conversations around that and becoming yourself and not apologizing. You don't have to apologize for who you are. You don't have to apologize for being Black, for being Native American, for sounding the way you sound, for being a woman, for being Muslim. You don't have to apologize for that. The beauty of life is knowing that you have a right to be here just in who you are, and self-validation. That is a part of our philosophy here, is coming unto yourself and helping the students come unto themselves regardless of their gender, regardless of their ethnicity and where they come from. It's important for you to embrace yourself.
Isn't it so powerful? I'm thinking back to 1957 and such despicable, unbelievable evil and negativity and hatred. Out of that has grown such incredible goodness. Isn't that amazing?
When you have darkness, there's light. There was goodness already, because even with those 9 students, there was goodness in every last one of them. And they tried. They grew. And even out of all of that, they did not surrender. Now, don't get me wrong, because it did impact them. It is hard for them to talk about some of this today. They still suffer from this. But they grew from it as well. And they came out as warriors. They came out of this as agents of change. They came out of this as pillars of society. And most importantly, all of them are servant leaders. All of them serve the community. I think love was stronger than hate. And at the same time, they also knew that it was not all of Little Rock. It was not all of Arkansas. It was not all of America. They received support from all over the world. And I mean the world, from Ireland, from Japan, from Germany. They received support in letters that outweighed the hate and the negativity. And I believe also that home environment, community was very important. They had a foundation, that foundation that began when they were born. The thing is, coming up in a society whereas you are told that you are less than, coming up in a society where you're taught and warned how to conduct yourself, that you can't look a person in the eye, or you have to step to the side. You say yes, ma'am, or no, ma'am. You're already prepared for what's to come. So your character is built. And then when you come into contact with it, sometimes it is heavy. I believe that the weight of it was very heavy, because they did not expect that much of response, the negativity. All of that was unexpected. But they did not let that deter them. They continued their journey. They pursued their education despite the suffering that they encountered in school, despite being denied the opportunity to participate in extracurricular activities. Minnie Jean loved to sing. You had Jefferson Thomas that was into sports. They were all into extracurricular activities, and they were denied that opportunity to participate in that. They could not even go to the school dances. They could not be a normal teenager to participate in normal activities.
I think that's something that a lot of people are not aware of, is that, yes, after they were allowed in to attend the high school, they literally had to leave after the last period, right? Immediately.
And they encountered resistance all day. It was not you go to class and you sit next to your classmate and they share a book with you, or you are engaged. They were ignored. They encountered different levels of brutality. And the kicker of it is that if a teacher didn't see it, it didn't happen. If you were attacked, if your books were knocked out your hand, if garbage was thrown on you, if you were spit on, if you were hit with lockers, if you were kicked, if a teacher did not see it, it didn't happen. And most of what they endured, they were silent sufferers. They were silent sufferers, whereas they held this because they were not going to be run out of the school, number one. They were not going to give up, number two. And they were not going to burden their family with these atrocities that they were enduring. They refused to take that on. So all of that stayed with them, and they carried that with them. And even the National Guards that were escorting them to class, they could warn them what was coming, but they could not interfere. So this was a will of endurance. This was a battle that they endured alone or as a group, whereas they exchanged stories, what they were enduring with each other, but they did not take it on. They did not want to give up, and they did not want to be pulled out, or their parents to pull them out, or for their parents to feel their pain, because their parents were threatened as well, and they were receiving threatening phone calls at night. So this went on throughout the year, and somehow the Creator gave them the will and the power of endurance. In pursuing this equal education, they gave up so much, and then they witness so much about humanity. And not saying that all the students were mean to them or attacked them, but there were a lot of silent witnesses as well.
And there were some stories of some white kids who stood up and defended them.
They encountered the same thing. They were attacked, or their families were attacked.
Because they dared to stand up.
Because they dared to stand up. What we call it today, the post-traumatic syndrome, what they are still dealing with today because of what they were willing to endure for a better education. I'm grateful to know them. I am grateful that my job afforded me an opportunity to be here and to be a part of this. So my responsibility is to share this story. My responsibility is to provide an opportunity for people to learn about the story of a people. You know, we talk about the Little Rock Nine. This is a story of endurance. This is a story of moral courage. This is a story of will and standing in your convictions. Also the story of children of a movement, because if you really look at the movement, you look at the Freedom Riders, you look at the Children's March, you look at all of the movement, and it's young people that are willing to make a change. And what is so sad is that our children today, our youth today, they don't know their power. Mm-hmm. They don't know the impact they made. They don't know the richness of their own heritage as youth, that they can make a difference today as they did yesterday.
Powerful. I wish we could spend all afternoon with you. This has been so touching, so poignant. I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Very welcome, and thank you.
Thank you. Robin White, the superintendent at the Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site. Rex Deloney, head of the art department at Little Rock Central High School today.
Rex, tell us about your life and your immersion there at Central High. It must be an incredible journey for you.
Incredible journey. I grew up in North Little Rock, and I actually attended church down the street from Little Rock Central, but it was not until moving away, living somewhere in the Northwest for 15 years, and then eventually coming back to Arkansas, that I had a chance to first walk into Little Rock Central when I had a job interview. And that was in 2004, and I've been working there ever since. And just the idea of walking the same hallways where so much history changed the world, I mean, it's just awe-inspiring every day. And when I tell people that I work at Little Rock Central, they say, oh, okay. Because it is a place that some 60 years ago, the reputation was that there were some evil things that were happening around there. But, you know, as we turn the clock, you see so many beautiful things happening, the diversity there, the openness, the camaraderie between the staff, trying to make sure that all the students are being successful. Mm-hmm. And so it's an important place. You know, it's just a joy to be there.
To me, it was one of my most touching moments in a long time to be in that school yesterday, in the halls, to watch this sea of kids going from class to class, and that camaraderie, that sense of family, black, white, Asian, I mean, it's so cute.
It is the most beautiful thing. And I think about, and there have been times in my 8 years there that I've had to check kids and tell them about where we are and why we are and how we got here. But then there are times when I have a planning period and I have a student of the Muslim faith, and an African-American student and a white student, and they're all sitting at the table having fun, talking together, doing their artwork, and then you just look at that, and it almost gives you chills to think about how not too long ago, you know, that wasn't that long ago, that everything was milky white. And so now it's just a diversity. It fuses the hallways, even in the staff.
So what I saw yesterday, what I felt is real.
It's real. It's real. It's real. It's real. And, you know, to be honest, even being on the inside a couple of years, I didn't think it was real, but I know it's real now. I know it's real because I've been a witness, like a fly on the wall, seeing students interact.
without any hang-ups, without any prejudice. They interact. They interact better than adults, and they're the role models.
Right.
And I tell them all the time, you know, and they say, Mr. D, Mr. D. I say, man, what you're doing now? I said, God put you here for this moment to make changes and do things. I said, in 1957, someone like you couldn't get a scholarship. I said, in 1957, someone like me couldn't teach you. I said, so we're a part of history. We're making history, and we're making history better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
The people who were students in 1957, I had no idea. I thought, cool, they were accepted, they were allowed to go to school. They said, no, you don't understand. My brother wanted to play sports. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be in the theater. We couldn't even, we had to leave, go home. It's like, that was just the beginning of the beginning, wasn't it?
Well, you know, I mentor a group. It's called the Gentleman's Club, mm-hmm. and it's about 45 students, diverse students. Many students might think it's African-American males, but we have Caucasian students in there. We have students of Asian descent. But one of the things that I always tell them, I said that, you know, this school is a pivotal school in history, and if it's something that you want, you shouldn't be afraid to ask for it. I said, because you think about Ernest Green, you think about Terrence Roberts, you think about Minnie Jean Tricky Brown, you think about Carletta Walls, you think about the courage that they had to come to school. Now, they had to have courage to just walk in the building. You're already here. They already made a place for you. I said, so you need to be really wanting to act on what they've done. You're on their shoulders now. And a lot of kids have done that. I mean, every year we set records with scholarships going all over the country.
Would it be fair to say that it is a result directly in many ways of the Little Rock Nine, of their legacy that lives on today?
Definitely. It lives on. And it's a legacy that every subject matter can use. I mean, in art we use it, in science, in history, in English. Students know about it. They walk it and they talk it. And then the beautiful thing about it is it's not only the Little Rock Nine. After the Little Rock Nine, you know, we have examples like Roosevelt Thompson, who was a Rhodes Scholar and who was an athlete at Central and a student body president and was almost meant to be governor but tragically died. And so we can hold him up along with the Greens, along with the Roberts, as someone that used their bridge. Education is a bridge. They were the bridge. They were the foundation, and students are now just walking over and accepting that.
Are the lessons learned at Central High, are they being extrapolated and used as a model and lessons learned or a guiding light for other schools, other school districts around America?
I would hope so. I think anyone that's in the field of education, when you say Little Rock Central, you say Little Rock Nine, there are visual images that come to mind. Mm-hmm. There are teachable lessons that never grow old, that are always adaptable to anything you do. So hopefully they are, we talk about Bloom's taxonomy. We would hope that the Little Rock Nine is almost a taxonomy for the way to teach, the way to teach self-awareness, the way to teach acceptance, the way to teach believing in oneself and being able to persevere. Mm-hmm. All those lessons can be drawn from there.
But I understand you have some specific ongoing programs that were a direct outgrowth. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, well, they have the clubs that are the civic clubs and these junior civitan clubs that are parts of that. And then they have a program that's called AVID, and where students come in that are having problems academically, and it might be something in the homes. And those students are gathered in the ninth grade year. They have to meet strict guidelines. But if they follow through in these guidelines, there's a pot of gold in their senior year. And I tell you, if you want a chilling moment, be at graduation when one of these AVID graduates gets up and tells their story about how in the eighth grade they were homeless or someone died and they didn't know what they were going to do. But it was until they came to Central and became a part of AVID. So not only are they being monitored and tutored academically, but they're doing things socially. They go out and visit galleries. They go out and give community service. They really try to teach the whole student and develop their character.
Is this something that a student is targeted, or is it a student comes and has to ask or sign up to become involved?
I think the students are targeted, and then there are students that are in the population that after maybe a month or a quarter, a teacher may say, you know, I think this person would be a good candidate for AVID. I think one of the most beautiful things about working at Little Rock Central is that, you know, I used to be a football coach. One of my favorite movies is Remember the Titans with Denzel Washington. And there's a scene where, and some of these lessons are still applicable to this, because that was a situation where it was black and white coming together for the first time, and they couldn't really see through their color to become a team. But it was not until they got them up late one night and he took them for a run, and he ran them all the way out in the middle of the woods into a forest, and he stopped them, and everybody was bent over and they were dying of thirst and exhaustion. And he told them that the ground that they're on, a Civil War battle was fought there. He said brothers were fighting brothers and families were fighting families, and a lot of men died. He said, so what you have to decide today is, what are you fighting for? Now, my analogy is that you can't walk through those halls, can't be in those classrooms without telling kids and reminding them that, hey, this is where it started. This is where it started for the whole world, the United States. This is where everything started for you. This is equality. You're walking on that same ground. I said, you're in the same cafeteria. I said, when you go out in front of the school, that's the same place they had signs saying, get away. And now all this says is, welcome to Little Rock Central High School.
Awesome. Very touching.
Rex Deloney, Fine Arts Instructor, Fine Arts Department Chairman, Little Rock Central High School.
This show was recorded on location in Little Rock, Arkansas. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
Said he wouldn't make a way. Said he wouldn't make a way. Said he wouldn't make a way. For you. For you. For you.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
The Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative was recently awarded the prestigious Phoenix Award by the Society of American Travel Writers. HLRI was one of four recipients of the prestigious award that recognizes international organizations actively involved in conservation, preservation, beautification, and anti-pollution campaigns that further the growth and appeal of travel destinations.